The Fuse Box Interview.
Well, welcome in, friends, to the first edition of our spin-off series, The Fuse Box Interview. And I'm your host, Mark Rose, and on this one, we have a delightful interview with one of the most beloved frontmen for the Frank Zappa band that existed from 1973 to 1975. A Zappa band itself, which is filled with mythological lore and utterly jam-packed with mythology that is overflowing with loreful mythology. I'm talking about Napoleon Murphy Brock, who is featured on albums like One Size Fits All, Roxy and Elsewhere, Bongo Fury, Overnight Sensation, and a wondrous, newly released and unseen for virtually ever, the video release of Cheaper Than Cheap, a concert film filmed live for a handful of lucky folks at the Zappa rehearsal studios back in 1974. And Napoleon is joined on this interview with Nick Chargin, the guy who has created, in my humble opinion, one of the best Zappa tribute bands to exist virtually anywhere, the Stinkfoot Orchestra. And in the words of the immortal Frank Zappa, these folks put the eyebrows on it. They get it and play it with gusto. Stinkfoot Orchestra is a 14-piece ensemble that truly delivers the goods. And we'll find out how these two talented guys came together to make this band a reality, as well as some Zappa ephemera some folks probably have never heard before. Let's jump in, shall we?
So let me just start off by thanking both of you. Ultimate gratitude here among other things, just joining me on the show here, but also for bringing it every time you guys come to town. As we were talking earlier, there are a lot of folks out there who attempt to tackle the music of Frank Zappa, some better than others, but I have never seen anyone bring the joy and fun better. I mean, I think there's enough activity in your shows for two stages. I don't think one stage can really hang with all the energy that's coming off of there. That is amazing. To play the music expertly is one thing, but to have fun while doing it, it's kind of what Frank had in mind anyway. But
that's the most important part.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
You know, it's like Bruce Fowler once, I heard him on an interview. And the interviewer had just seen him playing with us down at Venice. And the interviewer brought up Stinkfoot Orchestra. He's like, oh, let me tell you about those guys. He's like, those guys get it. You put in the work and then you have fun with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that shows. That's not hyperbole. It is absolutely true. You know, it's funny. I was just thinking about this today after this post wave of positive blue activity that's happened all over the country. Can you imagine
Amen to that.
Yeah. Can you imagine what Frank would be doing with all of the stuff that's happening in this?
I don't have to imagine. I know. Because we did it.
So. That's right. That's exactly right.
We did it many times, and I don't have to imagine, because I would be waiting, for the phone call to come. Napoleon, what are you doing? Come up to my room. You won't believe what we're going to do next, though. The sucker's getting ready to go down.
Yes. Yes, I know. Which actually brings me to one of the questions I wanted to bring up is in the Frank Zappa mythology, it's the Marty Pirellis character who apparently introduced you to Frank. Is that how it happened? Is that the mythic lore?
Marty Pirellis is Frank Zappa's road manager. Marty Pirellis is very instrumental in being one of the best parts of what the subtitle of my book is about, how and why Frank Zappa created the Roxy family. You see, all the musicians in the Roxy video, that's a family, okay? Mm-hmm. It's not a family of musicians. It's a family of specialists who also play instruments. Okay. And he created that family because he only had an extended family. He didn't have a real family. And so he created his real family, people that could help him through life rather than just living off of the resources that he created and that he received because of his hard work. Marty Pirellis was like, maybe, let's see, 6, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. He was the ninth person in the family. Marty Pirellis, when they were in Australia, something happened that created something that you're going to read in the book called the Sal Marquez Syndrome. Okay? Mm-hmm. Nick knows about the Sal Marquez Syndrome. I don't know if I'm going to put that in the book or not, but there is something.
It's a working title.
Yeah, working title. Working.
There's something that's attached to the Sal Marquez syndrome that it doesn't matter how it became. It's what happens to you if you are labeled with it. If Marty Pirellis comes to your hotel room, to you at any time, and says, aisle or window, and you go, aisle or window, what are you talking about? He says, aisle or window. I got a ticket for you, and you're going home now because you've just been fired, and I just want to find out, would you like to sit in the aisle or sit at the window? That's how you know you're fired.
Oh, okay. Man.
That's one of the roles of Marty Pirellis.
Oh, wow.
Here's the system. Contract said we get paid in cash. The people that bought the tickets paid you cash, so therefore that shouldn't be a problem of you paying us in cash. The equipment is set up. We did the sound check. We're ready to go. Now, where's the money, Mopo? You know, where's the money? And then the promoter's going to say, well, you know, No, Marty says, no, that's not how the contract reads. The contract reads that you count the money and I recount the money. And then if it's right, then it's showtime. So as soon as Marty gets the money right from the promoter, him jiving and trying to be slick, whoa, and Marty's from Baltimore, Maryland, where Frank's from, he goes and knocks on the door, and Frank looks up and Marty says, showtime.
Yeah. Hey, but Napoleon, you were starting to tell the story about how Frank was on tour in Australia. Well,
I'm getting to, but I'm just showing some of the characteristics and some of the duties of Marty Pirellis, which are wide and quite extended. Okay, so Australia started the Sal Marquez syndrome, and Marty, as Frank's road manager, you know, he knows how important it is for Frank to go on stage and he's happy and smiling because it's going to be a great show that way. Well, he knew that Frank wasn't too happy about something that happened at the end of the show in Australia. And so it's his job to be like part psychologist, too, you know. And so what he did, since Gail's parents live in Hawaii, yeah, Marty said, hey, listen, Gail, I need to do something because I don't need Frank to go to Europe in 4 days and be in a bad mood. He said, so I'm going to tell him that you need to stop in Hawaii to see your parents because there's something going on that you have to address right away. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to reroute your tickets instead of straight to Los Angeles and stop over in Hawaii and you can go be see your parents. And then I'm going to put Frank in the King Kamehameha Hotel. In 1973, women on the beach, they either wore only bottoms or they wore nothing. Okay. So he set Frank up in a suite in the King Kamehameha Hotel, which has a balcony looking at the Waikiki Beach. And Frank looks and he sits down with his guitar and he's going like, I'll be okay. I think I'll be okay. With Gail coming back, it doesn't matter. She's visiting her parents right now, okay? So Marty says, wow, okay, damn, okay, my job is done. Wow, this is paradise. Man, look at all these women. He says, let me see if I can go out and get lucky. So he's walking through Waikiki, and he goes through the middle of Waikiki, a place called the Marketplace. He goes through there, and he sees all these activities. And he walks through, and at the end of the Marketplace is a parking lot. And it's the parking lot for a hotel called the Coral Reef Hotel. On the right-hand side is the pool hall that most of the Samoans hang out at and smoke Thai stick. Mm-hmm. Anyway, on the left is the hotel called the Coral Reef Hotel. But on the side, in the back of the hotel, is a restaurant. And the name of the restaurant is called the Red Noodle, okay? And so it's a Wednesday night, and he sees all these people lined up all the way around to the front of the entrance of the hotel. So Marty Perellis goes up to the Samoan bouncers, because all bouncers in Hawaii are Samoan. You don't act out, you know what I mean? Because they weigh at least 300 pounds. Okay? And they don't argue with it. They pick you up and drop you on the concrete, and then you don't talk anymore.
That's right. Very effective.
You thought you were saying, you know, when you thought you were the big bad person from the mainland, it doesn't work anymore. Anyway, Marty says, why are these people lined up? Who's here? And the bouncer says, Communication Plus. He says, well, who's Communication Plus? He says, well, obviously, you're a tourist if you don't know who Communication Plus is. So you need to get in this line, because people in this line can't come in until 12 o'clock, because this band is brought over here every 3 or 4 months to play for the locals, the bartenders, the waitresses, the dishwashers, you know, the maitre d's, you know, and the waiters and everything. Well, they get off at 10 o'clock. So they have from 10 to midnight to get in there so they can, you know, relieve themselves of the having to deal with all the tourists all day long, you know, and being, you know, cordial and gracious to them, you know, and diplomatic when sometimes the tourists, they think their shit don't stink, et cetera,
right,
et cetera. Anyway, he says, so and what happens is that they come in before 10, after by 12 midnight. And then if there's any room left in the venue, then all of you can come in until it fills up. Okay, so he got in. And so he walks in and he's listening to the band and everybody's getting down, you know, and everything. And he looks on the stage, he sees the bass players playing bass and singing background sometimes. He sees the drummer singing along with the lead singer, like a duo. And he's playing the drums too. And he sees the guitar player just whopping it out. And he sees the keyboard player with a sax hanging on his neck. And then he sees this other guy that is standing there with a sax hanging on his neck. And he's singing lead and seems to be singing lead and background in some songs. And then he's playing bongos with marimba mallets. And every chance he gets, he does a little dance, you know, and then he comes back and he says, well, wait a minute. Saxophone players are supposed to play saxophone. Singers are supposed to sing, you know, and okay, this is unusual, you know. So he runs back to the hotel and says, Frank, get up. You got to come and see this. Frank says, what? See what? He says, you got to come and see the saxophone player. Frank says, I've seen saxophone players. He says, not like this, you have it. What we were doing before it was even invented or created or put into words, we were multitasking. If I do five things, if people in my band, they think, well, if he can do five, at least I can do two. Okay? And I don't have to ask them to do it, you know, because they do it because, well, I don't want to look like stupid standing up here like a, you know. And so it was the type of thing that happened. And so Frank comes back. He says, no, get up. You got to come and see this, Frank. You're not going to regret it. So he says, okay, Gail, get dressed. You're coming with me. So they come and they have to sit in the back of the room. And for 3 hours, he listens to the band play some kind of little incredible music, you know, for five pieces that sounded like seven. Mm-hmm. Because the keyboard player who also plays sax, I also played keyboard and sax, and we played sax together. Okay, we both also played flute, okay? And so when I play flute, if I'm singing a song like, you know, People Make the World Go Round, People Make the World Go, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, people, flute, and lead vocalist at the same time. It's called multitasking now. But we were doing that back then. And we were also playing hip-hop in 1973. We called it San Jose Funk.
Oh.
Now they call it hip-hop. And we go, okay. But now they wear their pants down in the back, too. And we used to do that when I was in grammar school. You know? But anyway, and so at the end of the set, because we played from 10 at night to 4 in the morning, 6 nights a week, every night but Monday night. So we were tight, you know. No music on stage. No, didn't allow it because we have to memorize everything so we can have fun. Anyway, Marty comes up to me, excuse me, someone wants to meet you. I said, okay, who? He said, Frank Zappa. I said, okay, who's Frank Zappa? He said, you don't know who Frank Zappa is? I said, no, I don't know who Frank Zappa is. Should I? And I said, where is he? And he points to him, and he's in the back, way at the back. And I look at him because I had really good vision then, you know. I said, is he on a poster in Haight Ashbury record store sitting on the toilet doing this?
Yeah.
He says, well, yeah. I said, well, what does he want? Because that's not a screaming endorsement for him. He says, well, you might want to meet him. It might be to your best interest. I says, yeah, but why does he want to meet me? What's going on? He says, well, why don't you just take a chance? It might be to your best interest. So I go back there, and Frank walks up to me and says, hello, my name is Frank Zappa, and you're my new lead vocalist and the first front man I've ever had.
This would have been 1973, right? Is that
August 8th,
wow.
To be exact.
How about
August
that?
August 8th. And I said, well, my name is Napoleon Murphy Brock, and perhaps you didn't notice, but I already have a job. As a matter of fact, that's my band, and I'm the front man. And he says, yeah, but, you know, you need to come with me. I've been looking for you. Oh, I've been looking for you for a long time, and now I found you. You have to come with me. I said, so excuse me, sir, Mr. Zappa. He's called me Frank. I said, are you a musician? And he says, yeah. I said, well, what do you play? He says, I play guitar. Really? Do you have a band? He says, yeah. I said, do you make records? He says, yeah. I said, well, why haven't I heard your music on the radio? And he says, I said, because, hey, I listen to all the stations, even country. I says, and I like the Duke Ellington phrase where he said, there's only two kinds of music, good and bad. And he's yours, good or bad. And he said, well, I think it's good. I said, well, why don't they play it on the radio if it's good? He says, well, my music's a little controversial. I said, oh, okay, well, controversial. Okay, well, thank you very much. That's not your real name, is it? I said, yeah, well, is Frank Zappa your real name? And he says, yeah. I said, why? He says, because it's perfect. It's perfect. You know, have you ever been to Europe? I says, no, they're going to love you in Europe. I says, there you go again, sir. I says, you know, let me tell you my philosophy about what you're proposing here. I never go to a place that I've never been with a person that I just met to play music that I've never even heard yet. I said, doesn't that seem a little bit ludicrous to you? Kind of weird. But thank you very much for your compliment, Mr. Zappa, and you have a nice day. You sure do. Oh, wow. Thank you for your compliment. I'm walking away, and my spirit guide goes, ask him who's in the band. I never question my spirit guide because it's part of how I woke up this morning. So, you know, I'm grateful. So I go back and I says, hello, excuse me, Mr. Zappa, call me Frank. I said, okay, Frank. Who's in your band? And so he says, well, Ralph Humphrey, Jean-Luc Ponty, and George Duke. I said, stop, please, wait a minute. Ralph Humphrey, the technician drummer with Don Ellis, the trumpet player that plays with the Echoplex, that technician is in your band. Jean-Luc Ponty, the classical jazz violinist from Paris, France, is in your band. And George Duke, the keyboard player that was with Cannonball Adderley after Bobby Timmons and before Joe Zawinul, they're in your band. He says, yeah. I said, well, fuck, man. Dude, you have to be good. And they don't play your music on the radio? I said, I got to find out. He said, so you changed your mind. I tell you what, I'll fly in Monday and teach you everything you need to know. You're ready to go on stage right now. I tell you, I said, dude, number one, I have a contract. I'll buy the contract. I says, well, here's the problem. You can't buy the contract because I gave my word. And when you give your word to the Samoan Mafia, it's best to, you know, live up to. But they have these things in Hawaii called septic tanks, okay?
Yeah, that's right.
What they do is that they cut you up into little pieces and they put parts of you in all the septic tanks all around the island. And guess what? You're never heard of again since. And your DNA does not show up, period. I said, so here's the deal, dude. I says, but I am interested in why they don't play your music on the radio and why my three idols of mine. I said, I know everything about these guys. Ralph Humphrey's not a drummer. He's a technician. Anybody that can figure out how to play in time signatures with an Echoplex going, don't know he's going to use it.
True.
And that's heavy, man. So I want to, I said to tell you, he says, well, you know, I said, no, you can't buy the contract. I said, how would you like it if I gave my word to you and then someone came and made me an offer that I basically couldn't refuse? And I trashed my word and just said, yeah, I'll go with this person because of more money. I says, and quite frankly, I'm sure you're not going to pay me more than I'm paying myself. Mm-hmm. So let's go about like this. Here's my card. When you're coming back, he said about 12 days. I said, give me a call and I'll come and listen to your band. I says, and we'll go from there. Okay. Well, you don't have to sing. You don't have to play. You don't have to dance. You just come up there and just listen. And if you like it, you know, you're in the band, you know, but I need you to do everything. If you decide to be with me, everything I saw you do, I need you to do that to my music.
That sounds right.
I'm aware of your interpretation. So how you changed some of that music. I said, okay. I said, so you want me to be myself? And he said, yeah. I said, well, that's easy. You know, I said, but here's my card. Give me a call. And later on, that's how it happened.
My God.
Marty Perales going out to try to find a piece in paradise. Along with the Sal Marquez syndrome, is what brought the destiny of Frank Zappa and I together, and the history that speaks for itself now, other than the things you don't know, that will be explained in the book that I'm writing in the first in chapters, though. We'll do it in chapters because massive amount of information. And every time they put something else out and I hear it or see it, I remember everything that happened and why. So I've been blessed with a kind of a memory that was my musicians. I told them the same thing. You know, you have to rehearse 3 days a week and you have to read the music, play the music, and then memorize the music because we don't have time. And then he found out that, you know, some of his rules and everything, I was already
practicing.
I thought it was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Nick thinks it's the right thing to do. Those of us who don't need to read music, but there's the horn players, they got so much stuff. I feel so bad for them. I won't do that, man, you know. But anyway, that's Marty Perella.
I never knew that it was such a contentious first meeting. It's absolutely amazing.
Well, wow. it was destiny.
Yeah.
You know, that's how destiny works. You can't stop it. You know, and you have no control over it. And when it happens and you recognize it, the best thing for you to do is to go with the flow.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it didn't happen. It happened for a reason. There are no accidents, dog.
No, there isn't. And that, of course, is one of the most beloved lineups that Frank ever had. So it speaks volumes. So, Nick, I want to ask you, because did you and Napoleon ever connect in the first place? Was it another Marty Perales moment or something?
I knew he wasn't living in Reseda.
Yeah, good.
I said that on the rocks quite clearly.
Yes.
You know, and I articulated, no, San Jose.
That's right.
So when I put this together, I knew that he was still in the area. And so I put it together with him in mind right from the get-go. You know, initially when I first put the band together, I was intending to put together a handful of shows around the Bay Area just to celebrate Frank's 80th birthday, which would have been in December of 2020. So we started charting stuff in early 2019. And of course, you know what happened in 2020. So we had more time. So it was like, okay, well, I guess let's keep charting. And so we kept charting more and more stuff. And eventually I got a little concerned about what I was going to be dealing with the family.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't know what that was going to be
fair.
Like. But I knew somebody out there who did know what that was like, and that's Andre Chumlin, who was with Project Object,
yes,
was his band.
Right.
And so I made a cold call to Andre, and we ended up chatting it up and got along really well. It ended up having a long conversation, and we spoke more after that and more than a few times, and he was very helpful. At one point, I mentioned to him, you know, my whole idea with this was to eventually get a hold of Napoleon, because I know that he's in the area, and that this, I made this with him in mind. And he said, oh, well, then you're talking to the right person because I'm managing Napoleon. Okay.
How about that? You can't make this stuff up, dog.
But here's the thing. Once Snappy and I meet each other, then he's talking about other projects that he's been involved with and stuff. And talking to my mom one day, and she said that she was talking to my cousins over in Italy, and had mentioned to them that I had a project going with Napoleon Murphy Brock. And my cousin said, wait a minute, he's worked with my man. That's what she calls him, is her man. She's not married.
Yeah.
And so I asked Napoleon, say, what's Brunello's husband's name?
Yeah, keep telling the story. He'll come up. I'll bring it back in as soon as it comes up.
That's
Ricardo Fossi.
Ricardo. Yeah.
There you go.
I have this thing called total recall. Better late than never.
Yeah. Well, but it's still there.
It's still there. Thank you, Lord.
He opens up his phone and he shows me a picture. And it's a picture of my cousin Brunella making dinner for him in her home. And he's like, I'm like, that's my cousin Brunella. He's like, you gotta be kidding me. You know, there's all kinds of little things like that that just keep happening with us, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of those sorts of synchronicities that are, they're not accidents for sure.
Well, you can't make this stuff up, bro.
No.
All the time, you know?
Yeah. You really can't. You know, this is something that occurred to me the other day. I recently acquired that 50th anniversary edition of One Size Fits All, right? Just one of my favorite albums in that particular. As a matter of fact, it's the album I recommend anyone who is not familiar with Frank's work or is trepidatious about it. Yeah. Just play that. But, you know, on that, it's either a typo or it's on purpose. It's referred to as Plorentine Pogan on this disc, not Florentine, which I, under years of research, have decided now that it is an actual cookie that he's talking about. A Florentine Pogan is a cookie.
If it doesn't say Florentine Pogan, it's probably a typo.
Yeah, it must be. It must because be.
It's Florentine Pogan. The thing about it is it's infamous and it's famous, and it's all those things in the Zappa world. That's one of their favorite songs.
Yeah, it's and your first vocal performance on that track, which I have seen you do multiple times, still blows me away. It's the nonverbal stuff. It's just the melodic thing there. It's just like, oh my God, I don't know.
It's with Frank, you know, the way we were asked to do his music, we had to make it a part of our DNA. And so he would write parts of our character in all the music that he wrote for us to produce for him. And, you know, he made us an offer we couldn't refuse. That's why we allowed it to happen. You know, you have to allow that to happen.
Yeah.
Let someone come in and start, laying things on you, you know, cookies on you, for lack of a better, the cookies that are going to stay there. You know, you have, no, I got this. But with Frank, we went, okay, go for it. Whatever you got, bring it.
Because, you know, it's very clear. I mean, even before we know the backstories of stuff like that, it's very clear that he always targeted a person's uniqueness and capitalized on that uniqueness. And that's what makes most of this work so absolutely wonderful, timeless stuff to listen to. 50 years later, you know, you're still listening to this stuff and going, yeah, there's just nothing. There's nothing like
that. And the thing is that Frank would often see this stuff in people before they even realized that before they saw it in themselves.
I know. That's absolutely true.
I played some shows down in LA with Ray. I was talking to Ray, and he was telling me a story about the first time that Steve went out on tour with them. Steve Vai went out on tour with them. And, you know, Ray said, you know, usually after a gig, I need a few minutes. So I walk around town, you know, and I'm walking around town and I come across Steve sitting on this street corner crying. And he goes up to me, he says, Steve, what's the matter? He's like, why don't they like me? And he was like, what? Why did the guys, they all hate me. Why don't they like me? And he's like, what, you really want to know the answer? Yeah. No. Do you really want to know the answer? Yeah. No. Do you really want to know the answer? No. It's because you're a badass motherfucker. That's why.
Exactly.
Oh, man. Okay, well, thank you.
But, you know, and Vi tells a story, too, about one time when, like, the first time that he went to Frank's place, and Frank was basically playing some rhythm stuff, and he just asked Steve to solo over it. And so Steve's playing and playing. All of a sudden, Steve stopped playing, and Frank's like, what's going on? He's like, how did I get here? I don't understand how this is happening. He's like, what are you talking about? He's like, I don't know why you picked me. And he said, well, he's like, do you think there's another Tommy Mars? Like, no. He's like, you think there's another Ray White? You think there's another Vinnie Colaiuta or Chad Wackerman? Well, there's only one Steve Vai too. And so he was so good about seeing these things in other people, even oftentimes before they saw it in themselves.
Yeah.
And incorporating that part of their personality into what he was doing at the time.
Yeah. That's a rare quality to see, but also to implement. I mean, it's just,
One thing that, you know, has to be, you know, realized from the top, Frank Zappa was a genius, Doug. Sorry.
Yeah.
I don't know a lot of people that I can say that person's a genius.
Yeah.
But he, you know, and history speaks for itself. I mean, what he did and the musicians that he had and everything and what he got them to do, it was genius.
I mean, I'm hoping at some point that the rest of the world will agree that he is probably one of the greatest composers of the 20th century.
You go throughout Germany and throughout Europe. Like I said, this group I told you earlier about Shake Your Booty. I mean, I had them come to be with me when we presented Frank Zappa Strasse in Berlin. They named the street after it.
Mm-hmm.
There's many, many German towns you'll go through as you're driving in the front of the town. You see a bust of Frank Zappa. Okay? And then when they have the conversation about classical composers, great classical, they say Beethoven, Bach, Zappa, Stravinsky.
Seriously. Yeah.
He is in that conversation and he's respected at a level like that, and because and they recognize genius.
Well, one of the great examples of that is the Ensemble Moderne. Those folks, thank God he had that experience towards the end of his life, because those people, not only did they get it, they showed up early and they were on their own clock and they were working it anyway. And it was, it just shows these people are playing compositions that were written for a machine, and they're doing it. And it is awesome work. Absolutely awesome.
That's their history of Ensemble Moderne. Alan Arkin.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He's the one that did the Yellow Shark.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was the one that put that group together.
From what I understand, they basically, they just said to Frank, whatever you need us for, we're here for it, you know?
Yeah.
Which was such a far cry from the last, orchestral album that he tried to do with the, you know, London
The
Symphony.
LSO disaster.
Yeah, he was not very happy with that.
No.
But
he's actually said there's more divas in that classical world than he's ever experienced in rock and roll.
But I'll tell you that Yellow Shark, I mean, there is no better illustration of just the genius that is Frank Zappa than his orchestral stuff, really, in general.
It is. You know? It's true.
And I think that any musician that gets into Frank Zappa eventually, you know, comes to the realization that, oh, wow. You listen to a piece like, Revised Music for Guitar and Low Budget Orchestra off of Studio 10. I mean, his use of harmony, it's just so unique. It's so original. It's so Frank. You know, I mean, it's like, it's nobody
there
else.
There is nobody else. There is no quality like that anywhere.
It's true. You know, he didn't compromise with his compositional style. Because they never said anything in the conservatory about that. He said, well, I'm not the conservatory. I'm Frank Zappa. He said, well, you can't do that. He says, why not? Well, it's not done. He says, well, maybe that's the reason to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it needs to be done.
Yes.
But this is how I compose. If you don't like it, don't just walk out the door.
He said one thing that has stayed with me. Well, he said many things, but one thing that I read a quote. Well, actually, he said it on camera, and I love this because it just totally disarms anyone who's trying to make a counterclaim. You know, they ask him, I think it was Dutch Press or somebody that was asking him. Said, so, you know, a lot of people, this is very strange music. It's very hard to access and all that kind of stuff. And Frank said, you know, I write music for the people who like it. And it's just one of the greatest retorts to any sort of a question about, yes, the audience is those who like it. The people who don't like it, well, there's plenty of other things to choose, you know.
You like it. You like it the rest of your life.
That's right.
You understand, you know, why there's a spiritual attachment to it that, you know, is part of your spiritual existence. And you say, I don't need to explain this because I know how I feel.
Yeah, that's right. You don't have to justify that either. Yeah. Nick, did I just read that you sat in for Bobby Martin?
I did, yes. Yeah, that was kind of a
good. Good on you. How'd that go?
That was fun. It was fun. We had a lot of fun. Yeah, I was actually. So I got a call from Ray 3 weeks before they were supposed to do this tour. It was 20 shows in 26 days in Europe.
This is Band from Utopia. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And he told me that Bobby had, you know, had a stroke.
Oh God, I didn't know. I didn't know that.
Make it.
Oh.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh wow.
I keep him in my prayers, man. He's, from what I understand, still half of his body's paralyzed, and
that's
and,
tragic. Sorry to hear that.
Yeah. 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 So, hopefully he gets better. But who knows? Whether he'd come back from that.
Yeah.
In any case, so I got a call from Ray saying that he was pushing me to everybody else in the band, saying, you need to get Nick. That's who you need to get. Mm-hmm. We need to get Nick because basically I play Bobby's role in this band.
Oh, God.
You know? You know, I sing all of Bobby's songs, you know. It's like, I mean, I don't play the French horn or the sax, but other than that, you know, because Bobby had approached me a few weeks or a few months ago. Like maybe 6 months ago, saying that he'd like to work with us, you know, said that he came across some of our stuff online and would love to work with us sometime. And, you know, I was flattered, but,
yeah.
You know, I never really followed up on it because if I bring him on board, then that means I got to give up.
Well, there is that.
but that's why Ray said, you know, we need to get him. And I could tell when I got there. First of all, we were supposed to do this tour of Europe, which was going through all of October. And then finishing up with 3 nights at the Baked Potato in LA.
Yeah.
But then there's some other things that happened where his wife Gwenda passed. Oh, and then,
wow.
Chad's wife had some health issues that came up too. And so they just decided that it would be best to postpone the tour. So we just kept the Baked Potato shows, which I was a little bit relieved about because, I mean, I'm doing this on 3 weeks' notice. My first time playing with them was going to be on stage. I wasn't going to get any rehearsals.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So luckily, you know, I think the things worked out for the best in that we did this. The tour got postponed. That'll be next October. And I'll probably be doing that if Bobby's not doing better. But so this way I got to have a couple of rehearsals with them. Are you a musician, mm-hmm. Mark?
Yep.
Okay. So you understand when I use the term muscle.
Yes,
memory.
I do. And having it on your fingers,
a lot of muscle,
right?
There is a lot of muscle memory that goes into play with this music, and you have to just drill it into your fingers, into your head, and make it second nature.
Mm-hmm.
When you find out that you know in an 8-bar phrase of 16th notes that you transcribed one or two notes in there incorrectly, and that you got to change those notes individually. In this long run, that is not something you do immediately. So I basically took the rehearsals, you know, we had 2 3-hour rehearsals. I took those, I just took notes and then said, okay, I just have to come in here and rehearse every day until, you know, put them back into my, you know, retrain my muscle memory.
Yeah.
First night, I made a couple mistakes here and there, but not too bad. But certainly second night, I felt much more comfortable. And the third night, I just felt right at home.
Man.
And
anybody can do it. Nick can do it. And not many, very many people can do what he did or what he does. I can't really do that because I play with a lot of musicians. And I don't know if any of them that can do what you did, Nick, or what you almost attempted to do without rehearsal. But it's the truth. It's the truth. Truth is easy. You don't have to make it up. You know, it's always there. But I swear to you, I don't know that many people who took it on, you know, and did it because of the level of self-confidence that you have about yourself and knowing that you're doing this is happening for a reason.
Yeah.
And everything that you work towards, for your own organization, Stinkfoot, is going to benefit from the experience that you're getting now in this.
Absolutely. That.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I knew I was going to be okay when, after the first rehearsal, as I'm walking out, I get a pat on the back from Scott Tunis.
Oh,
that's a huge thing. That's a huge thing.
Really?
I understand that's a huge thing. I take that. So it was fun. All the guys in the band were great with me. They're very cordial. They're very welcoming. The crowd was great. I don't know if I told you, Napoleon, or did I tell you that Eddie Jobson showed up the first night?
With his son. Yeah, you told me with his son.
Yeah, yeah.
It looked like the young Eddie Jobson.
Yeah, he looked just like him. His son looked just like him.
Yeah.
And so to get a lot of love from the people that came there. You know, Arthur Caro came on the last night, sat in. And, I've become good friends with Arthur, just the sweetest man.
Yeah. He sat in with Stinkfoot, too.
He has. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, so it was a great experience. No offense to Band from Utopia, but I like my band.
like I said, you guys are having fun, and it just is...
And I have to agree, but what you created was a cut above what a Band Utopia created to do the presentation of Zappa Music. You know, what you created, Nick, was it's a cut above, though.
The other thing is, as I said, the first time we had a chance to chat is that you're pulling out compositions that I don't think I have ever actually seen perform before. Going back, finding some rare stuff that's just like, oh, that doesn't get covered ever. You know, that's just wonderful stuff. I mean, Teenage Prostitute comes to mind immediately, but those kinds of things are just, it's just great. It's wonderful to hear that stuff. And also in tempo and all,
There's so much, you know, I mean, and so, you know, I feel in many ways, I've taken on this task. And so now I have a responsibility.
Yeah.
I know that on any given night, we may be somebody's introduction to Frank Zappa.
That's right.
And I don't take that lightly. It's important that it be presented in a way that I would feel confident presenting it to Frank.
Yes.
You know,
right.
And so much of it has to do with the people that I work with, too. I mean, we're a family, you know? I mean, it shows.
It shows.
There's a lot of love.
Yeah, there's a vibe there. there clearly is.
The happiest people that he got an offer, that he got a chance to do this thing with the Band from Utopia, the happiest people about that for him were the whole band. Well, good for you, Nick. I mean, they were, every band member rooted him on and, you know, congratulated him and said, you earned that. Go, because you did what you did with us and you've earned that. And so, yeah, we're behind you 300%.
That's amazing. Yeah.
That helps. You know, that really helps.
It's more than a vote of confidence.
I'm a very lucky man.
But I think, you know, you attract that, Nick. So that's what it is. Is there any plans to do Zappanale or any of those kind of shows out of the country at some point in time?
Yeah, you know, the thing is, it's not like bringing a 6-piece band over there, you know?
No, it's not.
You know, with crew included, you know, there's 18 of us. So that's not cheap. And Zappanale, it used to be that they paid for everybody's, plane fare, but they aren't in a position to do that any longer.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be happy to go over to Europe if we were to have some funding or to have advances that, you know, that will cover our costs.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely.
Well, here's what I think. If you like my 2 cents on that, I think that the tour this year didn't happen for a reason. I also think that the tour that they've rescheduled for next year, the same tour, and I'm almost 99.5% sure that Nick is going to be there taking Bobby's place. What it's going to do, because when Nick tried to go before, he learned about, you know, the expense and everything, and he doesn't know anyone over in Europe, and he doesn't know the venues, and they don't know him. Guess what's going to happen now? We're a band from Utopia. They're going to meet Nick Charging, and they are going to embrace him, because no one does. He's the only one in the band from Utopia that can sing my songs because he practices them with me all the time. I don't practice them with anyone else on this planet, you know? But he practices singing them with me all the time, and I don't sing wrong. Okay, I don't do that.
I got to tell you that. So the first time that Napoleon came to a rehearsal, there were two things that stood out to me. The first thing that stood out was when we were done and Napoleon was breaking down his horn. He's in the front room. I don't know what to expect. You know, it's the first time playing with us and everything. And he's like, you done good, Nick. Mm. He said, you done good. Frank would have been proud. And so that's wonderful.
Yes.
But the other thing that will always stick in my memory is the first time that we're sitting there playing and you hear him saying,
And in your dreams.
It's like, oh my God. It's happening in this room.
You may say I'm the only one who can sing his songs, but he's the only one that sings his songs like him.
Yeah.
That's because I'm me.
But that's right.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, the other thing about it is too, is see, now what's going to happen is he's going to go over there and not only introduce himself to Europe, and the questions are going to be asked, well, where'd this guy come from? And then the interviews with Ben from Utopia, they have no choice. They have to tell who he is, where he's from, and what he's all about. And so it's going to be in all the newspaper articles. It's going to be in all the interviews. You know, it's the DNA of Stinkfoot. It's going to be there. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the difference in trying to go over there when you've never been there before, or your band has never been heard there before, okay? The way God sets things up, you know, and there's no accidents. He set it up for Nick to go over there and introduce himself because he's going to be known for who Stinkfoot is by what he does with Band from Utopia. What he's going to bring to Band from Utopia, one thing for just one thing out of so many, is that there will be a person in that band that can sing songs by Napoleon Murphy Brock now.
and I can sing the songs sung by Wildman Fisher and by
Bobby Martin. But the thing about it is that, you know, all of that's great, but if you can sing the songs by Napoleon Murphy Brock,
that's right,
you can do that. I'm not gonna take some of the stuff from me. You have to practice with me to be able to do that because the fans know the music.
Yeah,
they come up to me and said, you know, you said that that was a wrong word you used. You know, I mean, really, I mean, for example, I'll give you a quick example of what you have to do. Okay, take your clothes off when you dance. The first verse goes, you know. Who cares if hair is long or short or sprayed or partly gray? We know that hair ain't where it's at. Okay? That will come a time when you can even be ashamed that you are fat. Okay? That and fat goes together. Mm-hmm. Now, if in the first verse, and I did it before, you say, who cares if you're so poor you can't afford to buy a pair of modical go stretch elastic pants? That will come a time when you can even take your clothes off when you dance.
Yes.
Now, if you okay, I'm going to sing the first verse, and I'm going to put by wrongly the middle of the second verse in there, in the first verse slot, because the notes are the same, the lyrics are different, but they don't rhyme at the end. Mm-hmm. And the fans walked up, Napoleon, you're great, man. I love you and everything, but you sang that wrong. Yep. What are you talking about? You know, no, you said, you know, take your clothes off when you dance. You said, you know, who cares if hair is long or short or sprayed? You played that, you sang that in the second verse. It goes in the first verse. So what I'm saying is that, you know, Nick's going to be able to go over there and show the excellence of what Stinkfoot Orchestra might sound like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're the rep.
He's going to be
the rep.
He's going to be doing it right, and they're going to be listening because Zappa fans, they listen.
You know, deep. Very deep.
Oh, man. You know, the first time I went over there, I thought they didn't like me. I went like, what the fuck, man? You know, kicking my ass here, you know, and I know I'm good, you know. These Germans are sitting there like this, like stone.
Oh, yeah.
But after the solo, and I came back and finished singing, after the end of the song, they went nuts, and I went like, whoa.
Okay. Yeah, very stoic. Yeah, very stoic.
No, it's
yeah.
A lot, you know, not so much stoic, but it's they listen. Listening, Frank always said, listening is an art. Ears are made for hearing. That's why they make hearing aids. Okay.
Right.
But back then, when I first went over there, I recognized that not only do they listen, but they basically record everything that they're hearing and seeing because it might not happen again.
Mm-hmm.
I come back next year. Then what are they going to do? Shit, Scheissen, they're going to say, which is
Scheissen.
Scheissen. You know, I should have paid attention. I should have listened instead of talking and shit. You know, and that's the way they are. But they're not negatively critical. But they will come and let you know that, well, everything was great except, you know, and they sing along with you. They know the lyrics. They know the lyrics, I'm telling you. And they know the lyrics and they know the melodies. And half of them aren't musicians.
No, that's exactly right. Yeah, most.
Every little, you know, idiosyncrasy of your animated performance, too. They know all of the things, you know. So the thing about it is, with Nick being as good as he is, as good as he is as a musician, as good as he is as a singer, but as good as he is in his knowledge of the music, because of what he had to go through to get his band, his orchestra, to achieve the level that they're at now, he has a knowledge of it that, you know, it's going to blow their mind, and then Zappa now is going to think change their mind about they're gonna be a little more adjustable when it comes to the negotiations. Mm-hmm. Because the people over there are gonna say, you got to get Stinkford Orchestra over here. You got to get them over here. And why aren't you bringing them over here? You brought this thing from Australia and they were okay, but they were just loud, you know. So why don't you do something that, you know, that that encourages us to want to come back again after we've been coming here for 35 years? Bring a group over here that keyboard player and singer that was with Utopia for all these shows showed us that he's one of us. He loves this music as much as we do. And he loves and respects Frank Zappa and the genius of Frank Zappa and the music of Frank Zappa. And to the point to where he doesn't disrespect Frank Zappa, because he not only sang the right words, he played the right notes.
That's right. That's where the proof is.
I think, in my opinion, because I'm a spiritualist, I'm not a Christian, I'm a spiritualist, is that God set it up this way because Stinkfoot is supposed to go there. That's what I think is going to happen. That's my prediction.
Yeah, I think it's a very valid prediction.
I think soon as we get Agent Orange out of office, I think it's going to happen. Maybe before, but I know it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when.
So I wanted to let you know that at this point, a reference is made to percussionist extraordinaire Ruth Underwood, a true virtuoso. She probably would say, no, I'm not. But we all know better than that, Ruth. Well, it was well known for years that Ruth never really considered herself an improviser. She played, skillfully, what was written and was happy as a penguin in bondage boy. Oh, yeah! Oh, yeah! To do just that. But for the just-released Cheaper Than Cheap live show, Frank gave her a little space to solo. And the origin of that solo was thought to be suggested by Frank. But as we find out,
Ruth decided to play her part in Double Fast herself.
Oh, so it wasn't Frank that suggested, why don't you just do this thing? Oh, okay.
He gave us the liberty to do whatever we wanted as long as we didn't fuck it up.
Right.
We were raising our hand like this. Ba-da-ba-da, ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. I did that. And so now I looked at George, and George said, oh, no. And then he looked at Chester, and Chester threw up with two hands. And Frank was, if you look at him, he's playing guitar, and he doesn't have a problem with it because he knows that we know. And we're like, you know, is that all you got?
Yeah.
We do this while we do that.
That stands out on that.
It was ad lib right there. All the jumping on the floor. None of that was planned. That's called choreography.
Yeah, right.
I mean, none of that was planned. We did all of that because that was who we were. I just got a letter from her.
Oh.
And she says, and she thinks she made mistakes in that video.
Oh, well, she
I know that's
would.
What they were talking about. But, you know, she says, I made some mistakes, you know, but I also nailed some stuff. But that's Ruth.
Yeah.
You got to understand. Yeah. When he recruited us, I mean, he hired musicians, but he didn't hire us. He recruited us because we already had pre-developed skills that he needed to process his compositions that he knew that other musicians would not believe them unless they saw and heard actual human beings playing them. And they said, well, shit, if human beings are playing, I guess we can too. But other than that, what the fuck was that? You know? That's all that, you know what I'm saying?
The fact that Ruth and Frank found each other, really, it was mutually inspirational.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that Ruth inspired Frank to write stuff that he may not have written for, you know, if he didn't have somebody he could pull it off, because Ruth is the only person that he ever knew that could actually do the impossible, right?
Yeah.
And so her inspiration, the inspiration that she provided to Frank, I think, you know, and it was, and she was equally inspired by what Frank was writing for her to play, mm-hmm. you know? And, I think it, that relationship, that musical relationship, I think had a lot to do with the direction that Frank went with his writing, and just where he went with music, you know, because mm-hmm. He was writing for her. That relationship is unique. It was a mutually inspirational relationship.
Well, let me tell you this a little bit, Nick, that's close, but the truth of the matter is he had already composed these songs, and he needed to find individuals who already had pre-developed skills that could actually play this. See, he had already written this music, but he couldn't find musicians who had pre-developed skills that could play it right now. He didn't have time to wait for them to learn how to play this or wait and see if they could play and then start writing. No, he really wrote it already because he brought it to us the first day of rehearsal. The beautiful thing about him is that he says, okay, the first day for me and Chester, we were going like, oh, shit, these guys already know the overnight sensation and all that. And he says, no, nobody knows this because nobody ever seen it. He gave everybody brand new stuff. For the first couple of weeks of rehearsal, everything was what no one had ever seen before, okay? So he didn't write stuff for Ruth in that format because that format had not been formed yet, okay? She'll tell you in the interview, the drum interview, that what Frank was looking at when he saw John McLaughlin's audience and everything, and she says she looked in his eyes, she asked him, what are you thinking? And he says, that's what I want. Mm-hmm. And she says, and the next thing you know, Chester and Nappy showed up. It changed everything. George literally said, oh, so we're auditioning for him? And Frank said, well, if you want to look at it like that, yeah. Said, but if he doesn't like what we play, he's walking in out the door with his roommate, looks like a dog. I released a CD called This Is What Frank Zappa Heard, okay? It's a live recording of that night because I was taping on 4-track TIAC reel to reel. Because he listened for 3 hours, because there's only 70 minutes on CDs, I could only release 70 minutes worth of 3-hour performance that he saw. So I saved some of the best stuff for last, okay? For example, but what he heard that night is I'm yet to put out. What I'm going to release on the second chapter 2 of This Is What Frank Zappa Heard is something that he saw. Well, number one, he saw and heard a 5-piece band play the theme from Shaft without any mistakes and without any parts missing. One of the most important things that each specialist that he recruited, one of the most important traits that we had to have was this: minus zero ego. Because if you have an ego, you don't listen. You prepare to say what you're thinking. And you prepare to, you know, object to what you heard. But we were like, okay. And then when he brought the first chart out, we were like, fuck. This shit, bro, this stuff. I mean, we already knew because we had already done everything else. Okay. We were already satisfied. We were at a level like, you know, okay, well, I'm happy with myself. I did all that I could possibly do as a human being and as a person of things that I wanted to do in music. And then Frank came along and made us an offer we couldn't refuse. He says, I see something in you that you haven't developed, but you should. And he called George Duke. He says, you should play synthesizer. George, no, I'm not playing synthesizer.
Yeah, that's right.
And he says, to me, oh, you're that great singer that he's been talking about. Well, here's saying this, because I'm a singer. I'm a keyboard. I'm a jazz keyboard player. And he gave me a copy of Village of the Sun. Okay. But I had heard him sing when I was in college. And I said, there's a block here. There's a firewall or a blockage there. And so Frank knew, because he said, well, if he can get these musicians in Hawaii to do that without, you know, forcing them to, them doing it on their own, because they say, well, if he can do 5 things, surely I can do 2.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, if he can talk them into that, I bet you can bring George out of the closet.
Wow.
And I'm going to work on
it. And once he started singing, then it was no stopping him.
That's right. No, thank God.
Frank said, I'm going to work on the synthesizer and you work on the vocal. But he didn't say that. I knew that. As a human being, there are certain ways that we show that we rejoice our happiness. Okay? Now, I'm going to show you, anytime you listen to a live recording with Frank and when George and the Roxy family, you want to know when George is expressing his happiness of playing the synthesizer and singing. You'll hear him go, Dick does it all the time. It's called an expression of joy. Because you've been freed from all the demons that were there oppressing you, who you really were. And those demons had been expelled through a process of family-oriented love, where we were one for all and all for one, and we were there for Frank. And he made us an offer we couldn't refuse. He said, when you finish doing for me what I need you to do, because I can't do it alone, but I need not just musicians, I need specialists. That's why I recruited you. I didn't hire you. I recruited you because what you already possess is what I need. He says, when you leave here, then you're going to be who you really are.
That's been true for many, many of them. Very, very, very true. Profound,
actually. I'll just give you two examples. The Fowler brothers. Bruce Fowler graduated from the Frank Zappa Institute of Futuristic Music, went to Disney, married his wife there, and they were both mostly responsible for the music of The Lion King. Okay? Tom Fowler left there and went with Ray Charles for 17 years until he died. And when they did the movie Ray, Tom Fowler was the music consultant. I'll stop right there. You got to buy the book to read the rest. That's just an example of what happened, of the offer that he made us that we couldn't refuse. Because we knew that he had seen inside of us something that only we knew. But we were suppressing it because we weren't ready to go to that level yet. We thought, and I won't make you yourself. You will make you yourself. But I'm going to present a forum for you where that part of you can come out.
Yeah. Yeah. So nurturing it.
And be
yeah.
appreciated.
Yes.
Jan Hammer used to come to our concerts and watch George Duke play synthesizer. Jan fucking Hammer. George introduced me to him. And I went like, George is a bad keyboard player. And then I started playing synthesizer and started doing movie tracks. I mean, movie soundtracks.
Soundtracks, yeah.
So that's what I'm talking about. Okay. The rest, you have to buy the book. And if you tell anyone what I told you today, I'll have to kill you.
Okay? That's right. Okay. I'll make sure of that.
Actually, I'll have Nick kill you because he's Italian. That's what they do.
God bless him. I'm so glad that the studio performance there, that Cheaper Than Cheap, got released when it did, because it really is unique for a whole mess of reasons. But it's such a great performance.
And you can, for a reason, I don't really think that they had control of the release. I think it was beyond their control. Because here's the deal. All these years and everything, and then a lot of people came into Frank Zappa's music and Joe's Garage and in a lot of the other stuff, you know, Them or Us and all of that. And a lot of them, because they weren't even born yet or they were too young to even know that that was an alternate form of music that they could listen to and appreciate, it's coming out now and they're going, what the fuck?
I'm glad, you know. Yeah.
So things happen for a reason, bro.
No question about it.
All of them now are waiting, they're like, when did they do this?
Yeah, exactly. It was what? Yeah.
1974.
That's right. You go back even farther, it gets just weird. But yeah, it's just an incredible legacy of stuff. I want to mention, even though this particular thing will be an on-demand thing, it is going to get a radio release the day before your show here in town. So be a little bit of something there. We'll be in attendance. I would not miss that show. Every year, look forward to it.
Well, don't come unless you want to have fun, because we're going to be having fun.
Oh, I know. I count on it. And any parting thoughts, friends, before we adjourn here?
Portland is one of our favorite places to play. We just have to say, the Alberta Rose, I mean, we just love that place. Love all the people there.
Yeah.
And we always look forward to that show.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Frank loved Portland too, by the way. Yeah, right. We used to play at the Paramount Theater.
Paramount, that's right.
And every town that had a Paramount, Frank made sure he was booked there.
How about that?
Every
wow.
city that had a Paramount. Oakland, California, Paramount. Because we knew what the acoustics were, because they were built for sound.
That's pretty rare back in the day. It really was.
Especially when they hadn't even invented the Peterson guitar tuner.
No, they had. Yeah, they certainly invented echoes, though. We had a lot of echoes. They're all over the place. But no, thank you both for taking the time to do this. And again, well, looking forward to seeing you both on the, I guess it's the 13th out here, right? 13th? Yeah, I think so.
Yes, that's correct.
Yes.
Thursday the 13th.
Yeah, and so we're going to rally the troops, and we'll be seeing you then. And it's so great to chat with you guys. Really thoroughly appreciate that very, very much.
Thank you for having us. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us, and thank you for all that you're going to do.
Uh-huh.
Hold us. Come in there.
You betcha.
Much appreciated, Mark.
You bet. Thanks, Nick. Thanks, Napoleon.
Thanks for joining us on this one, friends. You can find all sorts of wonderment at our webpage, thefuseboxshow.com. And thanks so much to my guests, Napoleon Murphy Brock and Nick Chargent, for spending some quality time with us, and also for keeping the music of Frank Zappa alive and very, very well. So, I've been your host, until I'm not, Mark Rose, saying, until our next cartoon.